Okay, let's pick up where we left off tonight. We left off on Deuteronomy. We left off in chapter 5. And Deuteronomy chapter 5, it's a reiteration of the Ten Commandments and, of course, some other things that Moses has to say. And when we went through the book of Exodus, there was another list of the Ten Commandments. And there's only a slight variation between what was recorded in Exodus and what's recorded here. And that's in the ninth and the tenth commandment. But anyway, beginning with verse 1, it says, "Then Moses summoned all of Israel and said to them, 'Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I am speaking today in your hearing, that you may learn them and observe them carefully. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, with all those of us alive here today. The Lord spoke to you face to face at the mountain in the midst of the fire, and while I was standing between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord, you were afraid because of the fire and did not go up to the mountain. He said, I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers of the children on the third and the fourth generation to those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." Okay, before we go any further, basically, like I said, this is a reiteration of some of the things that were written in Exodus, but nevertheless, you know, it says a great deal. Like when he says in that verse 1, "His hero Israel, the statutes, the ordinances, what I am speaking today in your hearing, that you may learn them and observe them carefully." And, okay, all these different ordinances, the statutes and laws that God has set forth, they're for our good, all right? It's like the Ten Commandments. It's really the things that God has commanded us, in essence, if you analyze it, they're not restrictions at all. In a sense, they're freedoms. You know, it's almost, you can almost label them as the Ten Freedoms, because when we obey God, this is when we are the happiest, all right? And this is when we are the most fulfilled. And this is when we find the most peace and the most, we get the most out of life. I mean, there's just no getting around it. This is what we were made for. I mean, we're made for God, made to know, love, and serve Him with our whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. And when we do, I mean, we really do find not just a sense of peace, but a sense of joy, a sense of fulfillment, a sense of happiness, a sense of completeness. Anybody remember where the first mention of sin in the Bible is?
Talking to Cain, sin is crouching at the door, its desires for you, but you must master.
Oh, good, good. That's the first mention of sin. When Cain was really contemplating killing his brother Abel. I mean, he was just, he became livid with his brother. He became so angry, and he's just beginning to just seethe with envy and resentment and malice. And God could see this in him. And then God spoke to Cain clearly and says, "Hey, sin is crouching at the door." I mean, that's pretty descriptive, isn't it? When it's crouching at the door, it's like it wants to, you know, pounce on us. All right, it wants to get the better of us. It wants to really, you know, hit us from a blind side, or you know, get us from a weakness. As sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. And then God said, "If you do well, won't your countenance be lifted up?" That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Right after he said that, "If you do well, won't your countenance be lifted up?" Meaning that, hey, if you do what's right, and if you do what's honorable, if you do what's pleasing to me, your countenance will be lifted up. In other words, you won't be consumed with all this resentment and bitterness and envy and covetousness and jealousy and hatred and all these other things that were seething in his heart. He said you would actually be a happy person. You know, that's what he was saying to him. So when God gives us these laws, I mean, it's really for our own good. I look at these commandments and I say, you know, if we just keep these laws, can you imagine how this whole world could be turned into, basically a paradise overnight? Look at what God has commanded us. I mean, remember when the person that came to Jesus at one particular time said to him, you know, "Lord, what's the greatest commandment?" Because for the Jews, they had like 603 different commandments, statutes, ordinances, laws that they had to keep. And Jesus said, "Hey, the greatest commandment is love the Lord your God with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength." And then he said, "Your second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself." He says that these are the two greatest commandments. In them, all the law is fulfilled. it's all fulfilled. You know, when you love God with your whole heart, love your neighbor as yourself, look around us, what we're dealing with today. It's just incredible what we're dealing with. When you know, I mean, I was just down there at the lake, you know, getting my exercise in yesterday, and it's just amazing. I mean, you see all kinds of different vehicles down there by the lake shore, and all these people have their doors wide open on their vehicles, whether they're trucks or SUVs or cars. When I say all these people, there's probably about a half a dozen of them. But they all had their doors wide open and their stereos just blasting. I mean, blasting. You could hear them a half a mile away. You know what I'm saying? And they're almost like trying to outdo each other with this bombastic noise. And it's here it is in the middle of God's creation where you just like to just enjoy it. And just soak it in, but you got all this noise and all this racket. I could just see almost like the devil behind the whole thing, just stirring the whole thing up to the point where he doesn't want anybody to enjoy this beautiful creation around you. Because what are we living in right now? We're living in a society that is becoming more and more uncivil. People just do not care about other people. One of the fruits of the Spirit is kindness, and kindness, in its essence, if you think about it, it's almost like thoughtfulness. All right. If you're really going to love your neighbor as yourself, you're going to be having their well-being at heart. You see what I'm saying? And that's just a tiny, tiny, small example. But just look in the world we live in, and we're seeing so much, not just hatred and animosity and resentment and bitterness, but just flat-out uncharitableness or unkindness or thoughtlessness, this type of thing. But if we really did love God with all of our heart, love their neighbor as ourselves, man, it would really be a paradise to live in. I mean, it really would, if you could just, you know, envision it, just following what God has said. Anyway, he says here, verse 2, it says, "The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, with all those of us alive here today. And the Lord spoke to you face to face from the mountain, from the midst of the fire." And you know, when we read this account of what had happened, is that whole mountain was on fire and it was shaking and there was trumpet blasting and the people were absolutely terrified when God would speak. And they were so terrified, they said, "Moses, hey, you go up there and talk to God, man. Just being in his presence like this and seeing this mountain on fire and quaking and, you know, this loud, piercing noise coming from the trumpet." I mean, these people were just shaking their boots. And even Moses was terrified when he went up to intercede before the people. And, you know, you stop to think about it. I mean, I've heard people say something to the effect that, well, the God of the Old Testament is nothing but a big bully because it just seemed like he was so intimidating. But stop and think about it for a minute. What is Mount Horeb? What is Mount Sinai? In comparison, let's say, to the entire universe, it is a microscopic piece of dust. And what did it take for God to manifest himself the way he did there? It was nothing. It was nothing. I mean, he was really concealing his glory in many respects. He was just trying to instill in people a reverence and a fear for him to say, hey, listen, when I tell you to do something, you need to do it. And it's for your own good. But people, unfortunately, they don't see it today. They just feel like these things are restrictions. They want nothing to do with it. But in actuality, if we would just follow God's commands, we'd be a much happier collectively and individually and as a nation and as a world. Anyway, that verse 7, "You shall have no other strange gods before me." I've said this a million times. It's like when I witness to people, I always ask them, what's the most important thing in your life? Because I'm telling you, if it isn't Jesus Christ, then you have put a God before him. That's what it boils down to. Jesus himself said, remember in the Gospel of Luke, he said, hey, unless you hate your mother and your father and your brothers and sisters and you, even yourself or your children, you can't be my disciple. Meaning that, hey, he wasn't preaching religion and hate. He was just saying that our love for him must be supreme. Nobody can come before God. No thing, no career, no school, okay, no person, not our piggy bank, not our portfolio, any of these things. If we put them before God, then that becomes our God. Just in its raw essence, that's exactly what it is. Anyway, he said in that verse 9, he says, "You shall not worship them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting iniquity of the fathers on their children on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me." And you read that and you just feel like, well, why does God seem so intimidating here, or it almost seems like he seems so bullish here in terms of, hey, you do this or I'm going to do this to you. In other words, he's saying, hey, if you don't obey me, what's going to happen? He's going to visit the iniquities of the fathers on the children and on the third and fourth generation of those children. But if you look at how it happens and you begin to say, hey, you know, you can't blame God for this. God just doesn't deliberately curse one generation after another of innocent people, you just stop and think about it for a minute, all right? Let's just say you had a father that was a liar, a pathological liar. Virtually everything that came out of his mouth was just a lie. Well, you tell me, okay, what's going to happen to his children? How are they going to turn out?
Liars.
They go, why? Because this is the example that's set. So when it says when God visits the iniquities of the fathers upon the children, upon to the third and fourth generation, you can't blame God for that because a person is a pathological liar. What if the parent was a thief? And this is what the child observed all the time. Well, how do you think the child's going to grow up? I remember watching a documentary one time where they had, you know, a bunch of gypsies going through the store. Everybody was just taking everything. They had all the little kids stealing stuff, and all these people were running around taking everything and then running out of the store. Now, can God be blamed for that because the iniquities of fathers have fallen upon their children? You see what I'm saying? It's the example of the parent that's bringing this upon them. God can't be blamed for that. I mean, pick a sin. It doesn't matter. Pick your poison. If the father's an alcoholic, the chances are his iniquity, even if the children don't become alcoholics, it's going to have a devastating effect upon the household, right? I mean, just reaping what you sow. So when people read this and they don't look, I think, deeply at what it's saying here, they can always turn around and blame God for being unjust and unfair. But it's not really the case, is it? Because usually if you have a parent that fears God, loves God, and they try to bring up their children in the way they should go, bring them up in the love and the knowledge and fear of God, and the parents set the example, well, there's a darn good chance that the children are going to do what? They're going to follow the parents' example. I mean, that's what we're told. I think it's in Proverbs. Raise up your child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. That's what it's saying here when he's going to visit the iniquity upon the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. And then in verse 10 it says, but showing loving kindness to a thousands, to those who love me and who keep my commandments. I mean, as far as God is concerned, we can't separate love from obedience. That's what Jesus said, I think, in the 14th chapter of the Gospel of John. He said, these people over here who obey me, they love me. These people over here who say they love me, but they don't obey me, they don't love me. That's the acid test as far as God is concerned. That's the litmus test to our obedience, our love for God. And there says, verse 11, it says, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. All right, now this is the second commandment. But hey, when we go through these commandments, I mean, this is the thing that I very often over the past 34 plus years or whatever that I've been a Christian, I've been witnessing to people, and I try to get them to see that, hey, when they say, well, I'm basically a good person, and you know, if there's a heaven, I'll go there. Sometimes I'll just flat out ask them, well, what makes you think you're basically good? And I'll ask them, do you think you keep the Ten Commandments? And they say, yeah, basically. Well, a lot of times I'll ask them, well, name three of them, and they can't even name three of them. But when we go through these, we begin to see that, you know what? All right, we've broken every one of these. I mean, have you ever broken the first commandment, put something before God? If you have, even once, you've broken a commandment, because we're told in the book of James, if you break one of the commandments, you've broken them all. And then it says here, you shall not take the Lord, the name of the Lord your God in vain. Isn't it interesting that so often when you hear Jesus' name used to punctuate a sentence, you know, or people say GD, or they're always using God's name in vain, you wonder to yourself, why is it they never say, you know, they never use the name of Buddha, or Muhammad, or Confucius, or Krishna, or any god you want? Why is it always the God of the Bible? You ever ask yourself that? I mean, you know, it's true. And virtually every language where people swear, they use the God of the Bible to use his name in vain. I mean, that's the way the devil wants to stir people up. Use his name in vain. Well, it's saying here that you're not going to go unpunished for doing that. But you've got to ask yourself, have we ever used his name in vain? All right, because if we have, we've broken that commandment. And there's another different way to use his name in vain other than to punctuate a sentence. You could use his name in vain by saying, well, I believe in Jesus Christ and I'm a Christian and I'm a follower of his. And then what? You live like the devil? Well, that's using his name in vain, isn't it? And it says in verse 12, it says, observe the Sabbath day, keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your sons or your daughters, or your male or servant, or your female servant, or your ox, or your donkey, or any of your cattle, or your sojourner who stays with you, so that your male and your female servants may rest as well as you. And you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you up out of there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. Okay, now that's the third commandment, keep holy Sabbath day. Just in a nutshell, what it basically means is this. We're no longer bound by the Sabbath in terms of the day, because we are told that in Colossians, all right? All this had its fulfillment in Jesus Christ. I know that Seventh-day Adventists are real sticklers, and they will always come back to the third commandment and say, well, see, that commandment hasn't been changed. Well, the commandment hasn't been changed, all right? It hasn't been changed in this respect. Remember when Jesus was talking to the woman at the well in Samaria? And the woman was saying, hey, we worship up here on Mount Gerizim, and you Jews worship down there in Jerusalem. Who's right? And Jesus basically said, well, you worship what you don't realize what you're worshiping. He says, but the Jews are right because they worship down there in Jerusalem. But he said, there's coming a time, there's coming a day, when God will seek those who worship him in spirit and in truth. It's not going to be the day nor the place that's important. And what's important is that we worship God in spirit and in truth. In spirit means that we worship him with our whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. It's not just lip service. And in truth, in other words, we have to worship the one true God. When we talk about God today, it's such a vague, nebulous concept because everybody and their mother seems to have a different, you know, definition of who God is. All right, that's why it's very important that we worship God in spirit and in truth. Now, here's the thing. What Paul said is, hey, it doesn't matter what day you worship on. You could do it on Sunday. That's the first day of the week, and that's when Christians began to worship. That's when they began to get together. All right? So, here's the thing. We got to ask ourselves, have we ever broken that commandment? In this respect, I mean, do we always regularly go to church every Sunday? And if you want to go on the Sabbath, well, then go on the Sabbath. But don't make that the issue. It's not the day that's the issue. It's worshiping God in spirit and in truth. And it's something that's to be done every single day. I think too many Christians today just have this, I think, this mindset where they compartmentalize God. Go to church on Sunday or go to church twice a year. Oh, that always gets me. And they think, well, it's my day to be nice to God. I've thrown him a bone. What kind of worship is that? That's not worshiping God in spirit and in truth, all right, when he's talking about the Sabbath here. But then he goes on to relate how, okay, why the Sabbath was so important in the Old Testament, that you weren't to do any work then. Well, it had its fulfillment in Jesus, and I said this over and over again, going through the Old Testament, of what the Sabbath represented. It represented resting in the finished work of Jesus Christ. When he died on that cross, one of the last things he said is, it is finished. Before he gave up his spirit with a loud cry. It is finished. In other words, we can't add to what Christ has done. It's not Christ plus. If we say, well, I believe in Jesus, but I feel like I can't get to heaven unless I keep the Sabbath, well, then what have you done? You've, you know, added Christ plus. And then, two, when you try to keep the Sabbath, where do you draw the line? I mean, you could really, I think, go... crazy trying to figure out where to draw the line on what you can do and what you can't do on the Sabbath. You really can, because it's an arbitrary line. It's a moving target. Everybody's going to have a different definition of what is work or how much work you can do, because even with the Jews, they could only take a certain number of steps on a Sabbath day. All right, I guess they calculated out to a mile, but then they figured, well, we'll take a few more steps off of that so that people don't accidentally exceed that. Well, you know, that, to me, can just fill your whole mind full of clutter rather than filling it with God, trying to figure out what you can do and what you can't do. I mean, some people get so legalistic in trying to keep that it just becomes stifling. You see, we're no longer bound by that ceremonial law, but we are bound by it in what? In spirit and in truth. Then the fourth one, honor your father and your mother as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be prolonged, and that it may go well with you on the land which the Lord your God gives you. Okay, this is the fourth commandment. Honor your mother and father. Have you always kept that commandment? All right, always in the letter and the spirit. All right, if you have ever have broken that commandment by dishonoring, by disobeying, by not doing what you're told, or talking back, or being disrespectful, hey, you've broken that commandment. And if you've broken one, you've broken them all. But here, it's the only commandment with a promise. And this is the promise, that if you obey your mother and your father, or honor your mother and father, rather, that it will prolong your days. In other words, that you will live a long life. Well, here, people can take this and they promise and they could run off in the wrong direction too, because they could say, well, you know, I know people who died in as young children, or they died as teenagers, they died as adolescents, or they died as young adults, and they always honored their mother and father. Why is it that they didn't live out their days? Why is it that they didn't live to a ripe old age? Why is it that they were cut down in their youth? Meaning or suggesting that this promise was pretty pointless or meaningless, or it was just a flat-out lie. Well, here's the thing. Again, you got to look at it from this perspective. If you honor your mother and your father, you know what? The chances are you are going to live a long, good life in this respect. If your parents love you, you know what they're going to be telling you? They're going to say, hey, you know what? Don't hang around with that riffraff over there that are doing drugs. Don't hang around with that crowd over there that's up to no good.
Eat your beans.
Even that, okay? You know, if your parents have your best interests at heart, what are they going to be telling you? They're going to be telling you to stay away from things that are going to be detrimental to you. All right? Now, if your parents say, hey, you know, whatever you do, never drink and drive. Well, if you honor your mother and your father and you do that, guess what? Chances are you're going to avoid a lot of problems. But if you dishonor your parents, you do something dishonoring to your parents when they told you not to do something, and you end up in prison, or you end up in jail, or you end up in all these different things because you're not honoring your parents. That's what God is saying to us, is that if we honor our parents by obeying them, then, in a sense, we are going to prolong our days. Because if they really love us, they're going to be telling us things for our good. I mean, that's what it boils down to. And that's in a nutshell. Now, put it this way. You don't always have to agree with your parents on certain things, on certain issues. I know that I look at things different from my parents, all right? But I still need to honor them. The fifth one, you shall not murder, all right? You know, you ask people about this one, and of course they always feel like, well, I've never killed anybody. I've never murdered anyone, so that I've always kept that commandment. But remember what Jesus said, it is written, thou shalt not kill, but I say unto you, if a man is even angry with his brother in his heart, he is guilty of murder. And he also said, if you say to your brother, raca, which means thou fool, in other words, raca means that you are calling somebody a fool with a contemptuous spirit. If we have a contemptuous spirit towards anyone, for any reason, we are in danger of hellfire. We are guilty of murder. To harbor this kind of hatred, to have this kind of resentment. Look at so much of the Muslim world today. They are just seething with utter contempt and hatred for the Jews and for Christians. Now, how are they going to get to heaven?
They fight each other all the
time. Oh, yeah. You can see it. You know, if you took away all the Christians and the Jews out of the world, they would just be killing each other. This is what I'm talking about when I'm saying that when God is looking at a person's heart, what is it that's there? That's exactly what happened to Cain. He just seethed with hatred, with resentment, with bitterness, with contempt, with malice towards his brother Cain. Towards his brother Abel, I'm sorry. And look at the end results. Even when God confronted Cain, he said, look, sin is scratching at the door and his desire is for you, but you must master it. It just got the best of him. You know, rather than looking to God for help in this situation. So, like I said, the spirit of this, how many of us have broken that? Have we ever had a contemptuous spirit for anyone for any reason? If we have, we've broken that fifth commandment. It says, you shall not commit adultery. Well, people say, well, I haven't committed adultery, but Jesus said, it is written, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, if a man even looks at a woman in order to lust after her, in his heart, he's committed adultery. So, Jesus Christ has put it in a whole new level, where now we're being judged by the spirit of the law. Look at how many guys today, for example, they are married, they're faithful to their wife outwardly, but they're hooked on pornography on the internet. Now, as far as Jesus is concerned, you're guilty of adultery, because that's what's in your heart. You see, and you could always say, well, technically, I've never committed adultery, but as far as God is concerned, you've committed it in your heart. And he says in verse 19, you shall not steal. Oh, this is a good one. I mean, I just feel like, hey, if we could just keep this one commandment, everybody in the world just keep this one, all right, in the letter and the spirit, you know what? This whole world would become a utopia overnight. Just the one. People, they look around and they say, well, everybody's basically good. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about, man? Open your eyes. Because the very people who say that if they misplaced their wallet or their checkbook or their credit cards or their purse, they left it on a counter somewhere in a store, you know what? That person's going to panic. I don't care how good they think men are. They're going to panic. And for what reason? What's the obvious reason?
They don't want their stuff to get stolen.
Because if they really felt like, oh, man, well, everybody's basically good, well, they say, well, I don't worry about that. If somebody finds out, they'll call me right away. Baloney, you're going to panic. Why? Because this is the world we live in. We live in a people are stealing from one another left and right. Look at all the swindles and the cons that are going on all over the place. People are being cheated. They're being lied to. They're being so much of what they own is being pilfered away by people who are just taking what doesn't belong to them. I mean, this is the world we live in. This seventh commandment, I mean, we would hardly ever have to lock our doors or, you know, look at all the security systems we have to have. Look at all the cameras they got to have. You know, why? Because people are untrustworthy. It's a shame, isn't it? I mean, and we're all paying through the nose. We're all paying through the nose for it. Every single department store, every single grocery store, every mom and pop store, every retail outlet, guess what? The prices of the goods have gone up because they need to cover the loss of pilfering. And then look at the insurance premiums, how they go through the wall, up through the roof rather. Why? Because I think a car in this country is stolen every 20 seconds, according to the FBI statistics. You know what I'm saying? Every 20 seconds, somebody's out there stealing another car. Guess who's paying for it? You and me and our insurance premiums. And the Bible says it clearly that these people who practice these things are not going to inherit the kingdom of heaven. You know, and I think we've all been victimized by thieves. I had a 57 Chevy stolen from me. I've had all kinds of things stolen from me. You know, a couple, 3 years ago, somebody broke into my car when I was jogging and stole my checkbook, my wallet, my keys, my credit card. And I just knew they were going to break into my house. I changed all the locks in my house and they still broke in, ransacked the house. And I mean, this is the world we live in. Isn't it? I mean, it's just sad because people will not obey God. And here's the thing. People do not want to have the Ten Commandments in our schools. You can't have them on the wall. You can't mention God. You can't pray in school. I mean, since 1963, we've run God out of our schools on a rail. We've run him out of our institutions. We've run him out of everywhere. We can't have the Ten Commandments there. But these commandments, they're 10 freedoms. If we just obey God, look at how free we'd be. Look at how much happier we'd be. What a wonderful world we'd have. Just keep the one commandment, in the spirit and the letter. Just the one. Don't steal. And man, it would become a utopia overnight. Then he says in verse 20, he says, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Basically, he's saying, hey, don't lie. You know what I'm saying? Tell the truth. Don't lie. Look at the lies that are going on. I mean, just the lie. How much junk mail do you get? And I don't know how many times I've gotten something in the mail that says, John Hunt has just won $1 million. Right there, big bold letters. You ever get these envelopes that say something like that? And then, of course, the whole thing's meant to deceive. The whole thing's just a lie. The whole thing's just a con because what they're trying to get you to do is buy something. But then in small print, it will say, if you have the right numbers or whatever. You know what I'm saying? It's all a lie. It's all a con. You know what I'm saying? It's all to sucker people into something. But it's saying here, don't bear false witness. But look how much deception goes on all throughout the world, you know, especially in politics. And then it says in verse 21, it says, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and you shall not desire his neighbor's house, his field, or his maidservants, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Now, this verse 21 is actually the ninth and tenth commandment. And in Exodus, the order is reversed. It says, thou shalt not covet the neighbor's goods, thou shalt not covet the neighbor's wife. But it's all saying the same thing. He's talking about covet here. To covet is just an inordinate desire to possess something that doesn't belong to us. All right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with wanting things out of life. But let's just say you go into your neighbor's house, all right, and then you become resentful or envious of your neighbor because he's got a bigger house or the things in his house, you know, you resent him because he has it and you don't. That's a form of covetousness. And that's what God says, hey, don't covet what doesn't belong to you. Because, of course, when you start coveting what doesn't belong to you, then, of course, that leads to all kinds of sins. And even Paul talks about, and I think it's in the book of Romans, he talked about, if it wasn't for the fact that God has written down, thou shalt not covet, he wouldn't have realized that that was a sin. because this is dealing with the spirit rather than the letter, in terms of this is what's in our heart. So what would you believe would really be the antidote for covetousness? But
if you take a look at all the blessings that you have.
Very good, very good. I mean, that's it in a nutshell. In other words, Paul said in the New Testament, he says, I have learned the secret of being content, whether I have little or whether I have much, whether I am hungry or whether I'm full. I've learned the secret. It is a learned secret. And here's the thing. If we can learn to appreciate what God has given us in life, then I really think we're in a position where we can request of God even more than what he's given to us. Like we are told in Philippians, with prayer and supplication and thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. But that's how it starts out, with prayer and supplication and thanksgiving. Thank God for what we do have. I always look at this house as a primary example. I mean, you know, the other house we lived in, I was totally content in it, totally. But it looked like the area was becoming more and more congested, and then the gangs were starting to come in, and other things were happening. I felt like God was wanting us to move. And I spent months and months and months and months just praying about it and agonizing over it, and I really didn't want to do it because I had the house paid off. But it wasn't like, well, gosh, I got to keep up with the Joneses. I got to have something bigger and better, because I was perfectly content with what I did have. But I think in asking God for something different, he blessed me, you know, in my household with this house, which I am extremely grateful for. But you see, it's contentment. We got to learn to be content with what we have and really be appreciative of what we have. And I think when we are appreciative, when we are thankful to God for what we do have, then we're in a position, I feel, to ask God for something even better. I really do. Anyway, when we go through those ten, we just went through those Ten Commandments. Anybody have anything you want to add or share to them? Went through. Okay, in verse 22. These words the Lord spoke to all of your assembly at the mountain from the midst of the fire of the cloud and of the thick gloom with a great voice, and he added no more. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me. And it came about that when you heard the voice from the midst of the darkness while the mountain was burning with fire, that you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders, and you said, Behold, the Lord our God has shown us his glory and his greatness, and we have heard his voice from the midst of the fire, and we have seen today that God speaks with man, yet he lives. Now then, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us if we hear the voice of the Lord our God any longer. Then we shall die. For who is there of all flesh who has heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire as we have and live? Go near and hear all that the Lord our God says. Then speak to us all that the Lord our God will speak to you, and we will hear and do it. And the Lord heard the voice of your words when you spoke to me. And the Lord said to me, I have heard the voice of the words of the people which they have spoken to you. They have done well in all that they have spoken. Oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and keep my commandments always, that it may be well with them and with their sons forever. Interesting thing. What Moses is writing here, because he's basically saying that the men, okay, well, basically all of Israel, because God was speaking from the midst of this fire on this mountain, and people were absolutely terrified. And then the leaders came to Moses and they said, look, man, look, this is too much for us. We can't get close to God because we're just going to die. He says, you go talk to him, then come back, tell us what he says, we'll do whatever he says us for us to do. And God says, you know, I really wish these people had a heart for me like this, or they always would have a heart for me like this. Because what did he see in them? They saw that they had a fear of God. All right? When the Bible says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. All right? The fear of the Lord. It's funny. I mean, I will ask people, as a matter of fact, I was teaching Bible study last week, you know, at a library. And I asked the guys I was teaching, I says, what does it mean to fear God? And the guy says, well, you know, you have a real respect and awe for, you look out at his creation, you just feel this overwhelming sense of reverence. And I'm saying, you know what? You're really missing it. You're missing it totally and completely. Because what it means to fear God is that you know in the back of your mind that you're going to have to be accountable to God. and I think I've used this example before, but I think it's really it's such a petty example that to me it makes a really good example. You know, I used to play racquetball every day, and one day that I accidentally left my my shaving bag there, and I figured, well, that's got to be ripped off because I had so many things ripped off of me. But I get back the next day, and the shaving bag was turned in, but somebody took the toothpaste out of it. And I said, well, I'm glad to get my bag back. But what struck me right then was that, you know, I thought to myself, I'll bet you anything, whoever took my toothpaste, if you would go up there and ask them, do you think you're basically a good person? Guess what they would say?
Well, yeah.
Of course I'm basically a good person. And there's a good chance, too, if you ask them, would you consider yourself to be a Christian? They would probably say yes, because the overwhelming majority of people in this country claim to be Christian. But here's the thing. There's no fear of God. Because if you had a fear of God, you know what you're going to be thinking in the back of your mind? Hey, I better not take this. Even though it's nothing but a lousy toothpaste, I better not take it. Why? Because God sees me. I could get away with this easy, but God sees me, and I'm going to have to come to God for this. You see, that's what fear of God is, in its essence, right? When you go back to the book of Daniel, you read about Nebuchadnezzar, when he threw Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into the fiery furnace, and they came out, you know, and he was just beside himself with the power of God and how he delivered them out of the fire. And then Nebuchadnezzar wrote a decree, and he says, I make this decree. Anybody who speaks a word against the God of heaven or the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, his house will be torn into a heap of rubble, and he will be torn from limb to limb. Now, that's the decree that Nebuchadnezzar made. Well, years later, when Daniel was thrown to the lions, and then God delivered Daniel from the lions, then King Darius made a decree. And King Darius' decree said this, men everywhere are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. Look at those two decrees. Which is the better decree?
King Darius, the second one.
The second one. Why? Because you can go through your whole life and have this false insecurity that says, hey, I've never said a word against the God of heaven. I've never said a word against Jesus Christ. You know, I've never once given him my middle finger. And you can go through life without a fear of him. You can go through life and stealing and lying, cheating and conniving, and just going all the way down your merry way, living in sin, having no fear of God. But you have a false sense of security that says, hey, well, I've never spoken a thing against God, so him and I must be tight. But if you fear before God, then it's a much better decree, because it's not only the beginning of wisdom, but it's a recognition that I'm going to have to count to God for this. See, people got to see it, but of course, unfortunately, they don't. Anyway, I think we left off in verse 30. It says, go, say to them, return to your tents, but as for you, stand here by me, that I may speak to you all the commandments of the, and the statutes and the judgments which you shall teach them, that they may observe them in the land which I gave to them to possess. So you shall observe to do just as the Lord your God has commanded you, and you shall not turn aside to the right or to the left. You shall walk in all the way which the Lord your God has commanded you, that you may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you shall possess. Okay, now, he just told Moses, he says, tell the people, okay, go back to your tent, and I will just speak to you, Moses, and then you relate what I say to them. And then he basically is saying, hey, you know, when I tell you to do something, don't turn to the right, don't turn to the left, do just exactly what I told you. Then he says here, you need to walk in all the ways which the Lord your God commanded you. What does it mean to walk? I've said it 1,000 times. You know, it means, hey, when you walk, it means that you are making a definite progress in a definite direction at a definite pace. So in other words, this is what God expects us to do, is to grow in love and knowledge and the fear of him. With each passing day, each passing week and month and year and decade, we need to grow in the love and knowledge and fear of him by obeying him and by following him. And he says, what's going to happen? It'll go well for you. It's a promise. Do what I tell you, and it'll go well for you. And we just, like I said, you go through the commandments, and you just say, you know what? If we just keep these commandments, it'll really go well for us. Can you imagine what this society would be like if we kept those commandments? But this society, it's become a pressure cooker society, hasn't it? I mean, we are just living in one big stressful mess because people have discarded God's commandments. They've thrown them behind them. And what does it say in Psalm 2? It says, Why are the nations in an uproar? Why are they devising a vain thing? It says the nations are the people of the earth. You know, they gather together and they say, well, let's throw off God's shackles from us because we want to be free. But it says in Psalm 2, it says God just laughs at them from heaven because in our attempts to be free, we become enslaved. I'll give you an example. Look at what's happened to Denmark in Holland. It's a situation where they're being overrun with the immigrants that they've brought in, but the immigrants, almost all Muslim, and they're not being assimilated into the culture, they're not learning the language, and they're not building up the tax base. Instead, they're sucking off of it. Well, it's a judgment from God. All right? Why? Because Denmark considered themselves to be so progressive, they kicked out God and his laws and his statutes and his ordinances years ago, and they have become a society that's just steeped in all kinds of immoral practices, and they thought, well, hey, we're free. But, hey, what happens? The Bible says God catches the wise in their craftiness, and that's what happens to them, and it's happening to us. We are cursed everywhere we turn. I mean, economically, I look at, you know, I feel very, very blessed to have this house, but I'm thinking to myself, my gosh, how are my children going to afford a house? How? You don't know how it's going to be done. They're going to probably have to come out with 100-year mortgages. I mean, you know, how are they going to do it? You know, that's the sad thing. It's because we're cursed. We're under a curse because why? It's not going well with us. You know, we're not going to prolong our days because we've just completely have thrown God out of everything. You know, I was teaching the Bible study the other day, these men's Bible study, and I was saying that, you know, we've thrown God out of everything. The guy says, no, we haven't. What do you mean we've thrown God out? What do you mean? I said, well, go back to 1963 and Madeleine Murray O'Hare and all these worthless lawyers. Now it is a crime. It is against the law to have the Ten Commandments in school, to have a picture of Christ in school, to pray in school, to read the Bible in school. Is that not kicking God out? I don't want to go down that road. I'm just simply saying, look what's happening to us individually and collectively and as a nation. Why? You can see it right here. He says that you may live and that it may be well with you. Is it well for us now? It's not well for us at all. But what's the solution to this? What's the solution? We go back to Chronicles. Here's the solution. God says, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I will heal their land. That's it. That's the only thing that's going to heal this land. But these politicians, these lawyers say, well, what we need to do is pass another law. What we do really need is we need to throw more money at the problem. No. No. If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways. That's the key. Turn from their wicked ways. I will heal their land.